This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. Broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth, and certainly, the ideas contained in these broadcasts are important for all people on the planet, because Jewish supremacism poses a real threat to everyone, not simply Europeans. I'm continuing now my spoken word version of Jewish supremacism, and we are now into chapter 4, which is entitled Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights. Now, this chapter is dealing with the Jewish role in communism and the true dichotomy between Jewish positions that they promote for the rest of the world and for themselves. We just finished covering some of the interesting positions of the Jewish leadership on race. They are very egalitarian as far as what they promote to other races, while among themselves they promote a Jewish supremacism and the existence of what they call a Jewish entity, a Jewish race. In fact, I quoted from some major Jewish anthropologists who promote the idea that the idea of race is absolutely a myth, a biological myth. They present this to the world, and yet some of these same scientists say specifically that now they can identify who are Jews by their DNA. And isn't that great, because now Israel can be protected and only true Jews can immigrate to Israel. So somehow race doesn't truly exist between the different races of mankind, but somehow Jews can be identified as a separate people for the purposes of Israeli immigration. Part 2 of the fourth chapter, Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights, will deal with what we call the Freudian assault. And this chapter is fascinating because you will have the opportunity to get an insight into the true beliefs and the true positions of one of the leading lights of Judaism and Jews throughout the world in the 20th century, a man who had tremendous impact not only on psychology and psychoanalysis, but also on the mores and values of America, and you will find his true Jewish supremacist feelings, his attitudes, and it's a fascinating issue. And then we will go into the civil rights movement. So here we go. This is Chapter 4, Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights, and this is Part 2. Psychology fell to the Jewish onslaught just as anthropology had. From the days of Sigmund Freud, psychology became defined as Jewish science. One of his Jewish biographers put it this way, quote, "History made psychoanalysis a Jewish science. It continued to be attacked as such. It was destroyed in Germany, Italy, and Austria, and exiled to the four winds as such. It continues even now to be perceived as such by enemies and friends alike. Of course, there are now distinguished analysts who are not Jews. But the vanguard of the movement over the last 50 years has remained predominantly Jewish, as it was from the beginning." Since the Great Depression, academic psychology has discounted the impact of heredity and attributed almost all individual human behavioral patterns and mental ability to environmental conditioning. It claimed that environment rather than heredity is really the source of all mental and behavioral differences among the races. Not only did the theories of Freud and his disciples attack the principles of race, they made a broadside attack on the spiritual and moral values of European civilization. Freud suggested that our Christian sexual morality was the cause of mental illness on a grand scale. He relentlessly undermined the concepts of sexual fidelity and the foundations of marriage and the family. In 1915, he stated, quote, "Sexual morality as a society, in its extreme form, the American defines it, seems to me very contemptible. I'm an advocate of incomparably freer sexual life." In Moses and Monotheism, 1939, Freud repeatedly attacks Christianity while promoting the spiritual supremacy of the Jewish people. Quote, the people, happy in their conviction of possessing the truth, overcome by the consciousness of being the chosen, came to value highly all intellectual and ethical achievements. The Christian religion did not keep to the lofty heights of spirituality to which the Jewish religion had soared. Just as the communist Jews had a political war with the czars of Russia, Freudians pursued a war against Western Christian culture. Kevin MacDonald, in his classic study of Jewish ethnocentrism, A People That Shall Dwell Apart, points out that Freud's Totem and Taboo reveals his role in the cultural war against Gentiles. Freud's speculations clearly had an agenda. Rather than provide speculations which reaffirm the moral and intellectual basis of the culture of his day, his speculations were an integral part of his war on Gentile culture, so much so that he viewed Totem and Taboo as a victory over Rome and the Catholic Church. Freud reveled in what he saw as his war against Christendom, which he compared with the Roman Empire and suggested that he was like his idol, Hannibal, and that he was meant to sack Rome. Hannibal had been the favorite hero of my later school days. This is Freud writing. I began to understand for the first time what it meant to belong to an alien race. The figure of the Semitic general rose still higher in my esteem. To my youthful mind, Hannibal and Rome symbolized the conflict between the tenacity of Jewry and the organization of the Catholic Church. Freud makes his Jewish supremacist viewpoint very clear in a letter to a Jewish woman who intended to conceive a child by a Gentile to heal the rift in psychoanalysis. His words to her were, quote, I must confess that your fantasy about the birth of the Savior to a mixed union did not appeal to me at all. The Lord, in that anti-Jewish period, had him born from the superior Jewish race. But I know these are my prejudices. A year later, the same woman gave birth to a child fathered by a member of the superior Jewish race, and Freud responded, quote, I am, as you know, cured of the last shred of my predilection for the Aryan cause, and would like to take it that if the child turned out to be a boy, he will develop into a stalwart Zionist. He or she must be dark in any case. No more towheads. Let us banish all these will-o'-the-wisps. I shall not present my compliments to Jung and Munich. As you know perfectly well, we are and remain Jews. The others will only exploit us and never understand and appreciate us. So, my friends, the most famous Jew of recent European history revealed as an extreme anti-Gentile Jewish supremacist. Isn't it curious that none of the popular biographies and documentaries on Freud mention this important fact? Not only did Freud consciously launch an attack on our cultural values, he conveniently labeled opponents of that assault as mentally ill. In Moses and Monotheism, Freud portrays anti-Semitism as a mental illness that arises out of jealousy of Jewish superiority. On the deck of a ship streaming toward the United States, Freud commented to his friends that the people of America thought he was bringing them a panacea. But instead he said, quote, we are bringing them the plague. The section on civil rights movement. Just as Jewish academics led the scholastic fight for egalitarianism in science and sociology, the Jewish media moguls led the propaganda fight for the civil rights movement itself, and it found most of its leadership and financial support in the Jewish community. Almost from the first day of its inception in 1909, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, was the premier organization working for a racially mixed American society. Interestingly enough, the founding board of directors had only one prominent African-American, W. Du Bois, who was actually mulatto, on the board. Most of the board consisted of Jewish Marxist ideologues. The U.S. House of Representatives and many state investigative bodies thoroughly documented the fact that all of the NAACP's founders were activists for the communist cause. Dubois even chose communist Ghana as his burial site. The NAACP's first president was Arthur Spingarn, and only Jews served as NAACP presidents from its founding until the 1970s. Noel Spingarn succeeded his brother, Arthur, and following him, Kivi Kaplan reigned over the organization. The Jewish leadership of the NAACP was little known by the public at large. When I came of age, the only name I had associated with the NAACP was that of Roy Wilkins, its African-American National Secretary. Because he was so much in the press and public eye, like most Americans, I thought Wilkins was, in fact, the NAACP leader. But Kaplan, during this period, was the actual NAACP president during that time. Benjamin Hooks became the first African-American president, finally, in the 1970s. And once an African-American finally made it to the presidency of the organization, no longer did the public hear much about the NAACP, quote, national secretary. From then on, the public spokesman was the NAACP president. In the recent black-Jewish split, liberal Jews are quick to cry foul at the African-American resentment against them by reciting the fact that the lion's share of the financing of the integrationist cause has come from Jews. They also boast that at least 90% of the legal effort for integration has come from Jewish attorneys and has long been supported by Jewish money. Practically every step of the civil rights movement's progress came through the courts. They decreed forced integration of the schools and ultimately forced the massive anti-white discrimination program upon America with the Orwellian name Affirmative Action. And here, too, Jews took predominant roles. The organization that fought many of these battles was the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, an organization separate from the NAACP itself. Even now in the 21st century, Jews still lead the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People Legal Defense Fund. Jake Greenberg has been active in the legal fund for years and was the chief attorney for Brown in the famous Supreme Court case Brown versus the Board of Education. In that nefarious decision, the Supreme Court, in one devastating stroke of the pen, initiated the transformation of the American public educational system from one of the best in the industrialized world to one of the worst. The new system, far from alleviating racial tensions, only heightened hatreds between the races in America. Even in areas where Jews were not the actual leaders in the integrationist movement, they provided much of the behind-the-scenes influence. Martin Luther King Jr. fell under the guidance of Stanley Levinson, who wrote many of King's speeches, including, some say, the I Have a Dream speech delivered at the March on Washington. John and Robert Kennedy warned King to disassociate himself from Levinson because of Levinson's communist record. King, however, found Levinson invaluable and refused. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, also had key Jewish involvement in their formative periods, and most of the nominally white freedom fighters that went south were Jews. The famous case of the three freedom riders killed in Philadelphia, Mississippi, involved Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, two Jews and one African American. The public image of the man who called himself Martin Luther King, his legal name was Michael King, is a textbook illustration of the power of the media to influence America. Most people still do not know of the extent of King's involvement in communism, in part because the media continues to ignore King's long record of communist associations. King privately declared himself to be a Marxist and told his inner circle that his efforts were part of the class struggle. His personal secretary, Bayard Rustin, was a communist. When King had to replace Rustin in 1961, he chose another communist, Jack O'Dell. His main advisor, handler, would probably be a more apt term, however, was the Jewish communist Stanley Levinson, who edited and probably wrote a good deal of King's book, Stride Toward Freedom. Levinson prepared King's income tax returns, controlled King's fundraising activities, and was also in charge of funneling Soviet money to the Communist Party USA. Only recently has it been revealed that King plagiarized large sections of his doctoral thesis. Boston University formed a committee to determine the extent of King's plagiarism. It determined that 45% of the first part and 21% of the second part were taken from other authors. Now, schools regularly revoke degrees upon discovering far less cheating, but the importance of King to the civil rights movement prevented the revocation of his divinity degree. The media have always carefully portrayed King as a good Christian family man, the epitome of a man of God. Yet King had dozens of liaisons with prostitutes, white and black, used church money to pay them, and commonly beat them. All documented by the FBI and admitted by the closest of King's associates. King even spent the night before his assassination copulating with and beating white prostitutes. Recorded on the FBI surveillance tapes, the Reverend King exclaims during intercourse, "I'm effing for God, and I'm not a Negro tonight." Unquote. The King records are so damning that the tapes and other FBI documents were sealed for 50 years. And despite these facts, King's Jewish handlers and their allies in the media were steadfast in their laudatory portrayal of King. Jewish and black relations have deteriorated in recent years as African-American political sympathies have become more nationalistic in their own right. Jewish association with black civil rights causes originated from the days when many communists saw the blacks as potential revolutionaries for a communist uprising. The communists, in their creation of the Soviet state, temporarily won the Jewish fraternal struggle between Zionism and communism that Winston Churchill described in 1920. Radical American Jews envisioned the blacks as an American proletariat, a transatlantic version of the oppressed serfs of Russia that could be utilized as allies helping to usher in a communist revolution. Of course, even non-communist Jews tended to support a non-racial definition of American, since they more than anyone are aware of their status as outsiders in European American society. Almost all organized Jewish factions supported the dismantling of the laws and traditions that supported European group solidarity. Jewish supremacists also worked hard to lessen the solidarity of any other ethnic group that could challenge them. After the Second World War, two major factors began to pull the Jews away from communism: the Russification of the Soviet state and the establishment of the State of Israel. To fight the Germans, Stalin and the Soviet regime motivated the Russian people by calling upon their deep patriotic feelings. Stalin himself, one of the most paranoid and ruthless leaders of all time, skillfully played one Jewish faction against the other until he emerged as the unquestioned authority in Russia. Leon Trotsky, Lev Bronstein, Stalin's chief rival, was forced into exile and later murdered by the Russian NKVD. Although individual Jews remained pivotal in his regime, Stalin saw all Jewish alliances as a threat to his own power. He brutally suppressed any potential threat he could find, and he turned the Soviet Union into a more nationalistic course. The anthem of Soviet communism, the egalitarian and anti-nationalist Internationale, was replaced by a traditional Russian hymn. Affirmative action for Jewish communists in the early days of the revolution was replaced by a merit system in universities and the military. Many of Stalin's maneuvers against Jews did not become clear until long after the Second World War, and many Jews were reluctant to believe that they had lost control of the Soviet regime. Even into the late 1960s, in countries other than Russia, Jews still constituted the majority of Marxist leadership around the world, including the United States. Many of these Jewish communists, though, had become somewhat anti-Russian and now called themselves Trotskyites. Only a few Jewish radicals held on to the communist vision as expressed in Russia. Most others reached for a new Marxist ideology rooted in egalitarianism, and while holding on to the social tenets of communism, began a migration to capitalist economics. And my footnote to that today is hence the neocons, who are almost all former Trotskyites, still Marxist at root in terms of their social attitudes, but they're capitalists and they're anti-Russian, and they're in the midst of supporting Israel in this war, Zionism, and they're in the midst of hurting the entire viability of the Western world. I go on. While white Russians reclaimed Russia, the Jews created the State of Israel, and it seemed that the old ethnocentric and orthodox prophecies were finally coming true. For 2,000 years, Jews had uttered the prayer next year in Jerusalem. And suddenly, any Jew could go into Jerusalem once more under their direct political control. During these years, America witnessed the transformation of many new left Jewish radicals. Norman Podoretz of Commentary Magazine, for example, shifted from communist apologist to capitalist advocate, from an anti-Vietnam War dove to an unmitigated Israeli hawk. In the 1970s, a flood of these new right Jews poured into the conservative movement, adapting to the tenets of economic conservatism, but adding the elements of social liberalism, egalitarianism, the New World Order, and, of course, super Zionism. Jews filtered into organizations of every conceivable political stripe, espousing different viewpoints, but always keeping a keen eye out for the interests of the Jews and the Israeli state. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the second part of Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights, which, of course, is the fourth chapter of my book, Jewish Supremacism. Appreciate very much your help and support. It's your contributions and your work in spreading this word around the world that makes DavidDuke.com one of the most influential websites in the world. And we need your help. We appreciate your help. We don't have any of the rich Jewish backers such as so many of the other side has around the world in terms of their web presence or media presence. And we rely solely on your help for us to get this job done. Don't forget now, tune in tomorrow for the third and final part of Chapter 4 of Jewish Supremacism. The chapter is entitled Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights, and it goes very dramatically into Jewish feminism and how egalitarianism is used as a weapon for Jewish supremacy. Thanks so much. I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio Broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddu.com.